just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jerry Mander, who the New York Times described as the patriarch of the anti-globalism movement. He's the founder and distinguished fellow of the International Forum on Globalization. A former advertising executive, he produced the famous Sierra Club campaign in the 1960s that saved the Grand Canyon. And his books include Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, In the Absence of the Sacred, A Case Against Global Economy, The Paradigm Wars, Indigenous Peoples' Resistance to Globalization, and his latest out soon is The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jerry Mander.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
And, well, we're very grateful to have you and to have your book here today in advance of its publication, which is soon. Tell me, though, is capitalism an ideology or a fact of life?
Well, what would make it effective? It's definitely an ideology. It's an economic strategy, I would say, more than anything else. It was a system that evolved in the 1700s, mainly 1600s and 1700s, and it had a good career. I mean, it did very well for the capitalists and for businesses and for the development project. Over the next couple of centuries, and that was a time when there were plenty of resources on the planet and plenty of new markets to be tapped and plenty of very, very cheap labor, including slave labor, for part of that time. And capitalism, was in its prime in those days, and it continued to be into the 20th century, but it's now up against major crises, and it's not going to be as successful anymore. And it is also suffering. It's time that we really had a careful look at it, and we see that it has a series of characteristics that are intrinsic to its form. That's to say, they're built into the model, which are no longer relevant and no longer successful on a planet where the resources are rapidly running out, and the economic disparities have reached a crisis point, and there are too many problems with capitalism right now to see it as a viable system for the future. And so the book attempts to articulate seven main points about capitalism that are probably intrinsic to the model and probably cannot be resolved successfully and will eventually lead to its demise.
And these main points are that capitalism is amoral, it's dependent on growth, it's also about the propensity to war, intrinsically inequitable, undermines democracy, and capitalism does not bring happiness. Those are the seven basic points.
Those are the main points, right.
I'm just wondering, and I'm certainly not defending the American political system, but I grew up in other countries, Australia, and spent a lot of time in Europe. And by comparison to the social democracies that have provided a pretty high standard of living for their people, full health care, 6 weeks vacation, pregnancy leave, child care, all kinds of things that the average American could only dream of, and what little we have in terms of a social safety net is already under attack. It seems to me that everything you've written in your book is absolutely appropriate to the United States, and it seems to me that American capitalists are amongst the most short-sighted and greediest on the planet. Since the late 70s, they've accrued enormous wealth and benefits and bought the political system, and they've conned the American people into believing that the inequality that we have today is a result of globalism and other causes, and they're even hoisting the canard that they're the job creators. If you cut their taxes, they're going to actually be the ones that'll save us from unemployment and penury. I mean, it's an amazing con that's been pulled off. But
right.
Is it universal, in other words? Is there still some hope for social democracy?
Well, you know, social democracy in Europe, in Northern Europe in particular, Scandinavian countries and some other ones, is far more successful, without a doubt, in creating the conditions of that make for a satisfied, contented, peaceful, and well cared for society. And one of the things I argue in the book is that we could do a lot worse than trying to copy the systems of Norway and Sweden and Denmark and a few other countries, or at least for the time being while we try to transition. But you're right, we are caught in the United States in the most extreme version of capitalism, well, you know, in laissez-faire capitalism, Ayn Rand-style capitalism, you might say, in which government intervention to help people is considered, you know, radical socialism and dangerous on the part of the corporate world and on the part of the whole right wing, the whole half of the population that's part of the Republican Party. I mean, this is just, and the United States, as a result, is doing terribly compared with other countries of the world in terms of most kinds of standards that one would use to measure. I mean, you mentioned a few, but you know, in the book I go through a whole long list of things like, you know, the United States has the highest rate of divorce in the world, and it's the highest rate of adult obesity. It's a very high rate of suicide, the highest rate of maternal mortality among industrial nations, highest rate of infant mortality, a highest rate of childhood poverty among industrial nations, prison incarceration, the murder rate's very high, the rape rate is very high, armed robbery is very high. Home ownership, on the other hand, is relatively low. We're right in the middle of most countries in the rate of home ownership, and that's one of the big standards of U.S., you know, that the U.S. values is home ownership. It's quite low, and the wealth inequality is very, very extreme. Life expectancy is, we're way down in terms of life expectancy, 15th in the world right now. Other countries like Japan and France and Spain and many others are way ahead of us. We have a relatively sturdy middle class, but we're not the largest middle class in the world by a long shot. That would be Japan and Sweden and Norway, and China is coming very up. But to me, the statistic that matters almost the most is voter turnout. Among the 40 leading democracies, the United States ranks last in voter turnout in most kinds of elections. That's as measured between 1960 and 1995. But, you know, at the average turnout is about below 55% of the electorate, even in presidential elections, below 45% in congressional elections, and much, much lower in local and state elections. So, you know, we're way, way under the average for most countries of the world.
But and, what explains, Jared, why the American people are so unique in voluntarily abdicating their democratic rights?
Well, I mean, I can only guess at it, Ian, but my feeling is they don't feel like it's worth it, that it really means anything to vote. They don't really see that the conditions will really change depending upon who they vote for and who they don't vote for. They've had a lot of experience voting and finding that a candidate says one thing and then you elect him or her and they don't do that or they can't do that. And so what's the point? And I can only, you know, other countries get 80% turnout routinely. You know, Austria, Luxembourg, Italy, Denmark, Sweden, Australia, too, has a very high, well, I think Australia has mandatory voting. But
yes, you get fined if you don't vote, yeah.
But most of the countries of Europe and even of other countries like South America and so on are much higher voter turnouts, and that's a real, real big warning sign, I think, of alienation from democracy and feeling that the government doesn't care about them and that there's no point and it doesn't really matter who gets to be in the government. And that, to me, among all the measures of satisfaction and happiness and well-being of a society, that's a very important one.
Yet billions are going to be spent on this farce in this year. Already billions have been spent. And billions more will be spent.
The Occupy movement did a great thing by articulating this 1% versus 99%, because it's completely brilliant that the 1%, but it's not even the 1%. It's the 0.1%. It's very, 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 very small number of people who are putting up these gigantic amounts of money because their self-interest matters. If they put up enough money, they know that the system will favor them in the future, and that's what it's all an investment. It's part of an investment. You know, Ian, you mentioned earlier job creators. There's a lot of pressure, especially from the Republicans, to lower the taxes of the richest people in the world because they are the job creators. Well, I don't know if you've talked on any of your programs about where those job creators actually spend their money. they don't spend it creating jobs. You know, something like 90% of the profits of the wealth of these people really goes to just betting, you know, going into these commodity markets and these gambling, these financial instruments. It's money buying money and money gambling against other money gambling. And it is all and they're not putting money into building material economy, to developing new products or supporting what they call the real economy that has been traditional in the industrial nations. Because if they do that, then they got to hire workers, and they've got to deal with environmentalists, and they've got to, you know, it's a lot sloppier to make money that way than it is just invested in you know, these financial instruments. And so it's a farce when they're saying that that the wealth creators are the richest people on the planet, because they're not.
No, well, I actually had this fellow on the other day, Nick Hanna, whose talk to TED was suppressed, and he's a successful capitalist. He makes the point that capitalists, the last thing they want to do is hire people. That's an expense. They only hire people when they're forced to, you know.
They go striking, and they want more money, and they, you know, they make noise, and they picket, and God, who wants that?
Right, exactly. So let's turn to one of the biggest, I'm not suggesting that you can aggregate your 7 points of what's wrong with capitalism: amorality, dependence on growth, propensity for war, intrinsically inequitable, undermines democracy, and capitalism does not bring happiness. But capitalism's incompatibility with the biosphere seems to be the real ticking time bomb here. Uh-huh. And I've spoken to biologists and ecologists, and they say, in fact, that the ideal population for the planet is about a billion at the maximum. We're up to 6, going up to 7. And there seems to be 3 drivers that are destroying the environment: resource depletion, population growth, and energy use. And let's break them down. Is there anything you can do about population growth?
Well, first of all, most people I talk to that study this and really look at the resource situation on the planet right now, as well as the advancing poverty on the planet, and that's related to resources, as well as the advancing climate change and advancing freshwater depletion. That's probably maybe the most important in terms of human survival, is the tremendous depletion of freshwater supplies, partly because of climate change, melting of the glaciers. That's where the freshwater comes from in a lot of parts of the world. And the glaciers won't be there anymore to produce the rivers that keep the people, you know, with fresh water. So the conditions for population growth are very poor. And a lot of people I talk to think that population growth is not going to be advancing as much as was previously predicted. You see all these numbers about it going to 10 or 12 billion and things like that. They say, I'm no expert in this subject, but the people I talk to say that it's going to be impossible because there's not going to be the food. Topsoil is disappearing very, very rapidly. Fresh water, the weather changing, the rising of the seas and so on, all of that is going to mitigate the possibility for future populations to survive. And some people even predict, you know, massive die-offs on certain parts of the planet, particularly in Africa. And I think that's very plausible, because if the conditions for survival, if the food and the land and the natural resources that people live on are disappearing, it's not going to be supportive of a larger population. Of course, I think we should simultaneously be speaking about this very strongly and encouraging. I'm a believer in encouraging population consciousness and encouraging people's getting the resources they need in terms of contraception and so on, to abstain from producing children or producing large families in their own interests. And I'm definitely a supporter of that kind of work. I'm not a supporter of mandatory, the old Chinese one-child policy and with sanctions, serious sanctions if you don't follow that policy. But I do think that there's a lot people can do to recognize the situation that's coming along and to try to mitigate it in their own behavior and in their own communities. So I do think it's already a problem, even from the current level of population. But if it gets to be bigger, it'll be a way bigger problem because there won't be the resources to serve it. And I do think that that will lead to terrible, terrible crises for people.
Well, you're obviously going to have a word with the Pope, Jerry.
Well, he hasn't called me lately. But if you get him on the air, I'll join the program.
Okay. Well, I thank you for beginning this conversation, Jerry Mander.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jerry Mander, who the New York Times described as the patriarch of the anti-globalism movement, and his books include Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, In the Absence of the Sacred, A Case Against the Global Economy, The Paradigm Wars, Indigenous People's Resistance to Globalization, and his latest book just out is The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.